the Skillful Means podcast, spiritual nourishment for yoga practitioners and teachers. I'm Sarah Jane Shangra.
And I'm Jennifer O'Sullivan. Join us every other week for conversations on integrating the Buddha Dharma, Taoism, and spiritual psychology with yoga.
Welcome, dear listeners. We hope you are well and hanging in. We'd like to start by acknowledging some feedback. We've heard from a couple of you that the podcast is serving as a resource in these times when we can't gather together and we don't have access to as many in-person teachings. And that's great. However, we can best be of support. We will do that in whatever way we know how. We're glad you're finding it beneficial, and we thank you for being there and being with us.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for listening and sharing the feedback when you feel compelled to do so. We really appreciate hearing from you.
Speaking of which, Jen, we'll be doing something slightly different in November that I think it warrants mentioning, which is this virtual retreat hosted through the podcast.
Oh, yeah. We're going to forego our usual discussion episode in November and instead drip out several days worth of practice material, like Sarah Jane said, in a retreat format to hopefully give you some resources, especially going into the holiday season. And we'll have a little bit more information at the end of the show if you want to get in on that. We'll share the dates and everything with you. So in today's episode, we wanted to speak to something that's going on in a lot of people's lives right now, indeed perhaps everyone's, because of the coronavirus pandemic. And that's that very heavy weightedness that's in the culture right now around uncertainty. And Sarah Jane and I thought that this would be a really great topic to cover in the podcast because the Eastern traditions, spiritual traditions, have a lot to say about acknowledging, being with, and making it through times of uncertainty. It's something that is universal and inherent to life on this planet. It's something that wise people throughout the ages have been grappling with since humans walked the earth. And yet we still find ourselves in some ways under-resourced or really thrown off when things get really difficult and when the path forward is really unclear.
Yeah, this seems like the right time. I was thinking about how if this were September 2019, we might be doing an episode on uncertainty anyway, because it's related to change. And many of us think of this month as a month of transition. There's the academic year that sort of gets into full swing. You know, depending on where you live, the change of the seasons might be dramatic. And so it just, there's more poignancy for me anyway in talking about this now. You know, I always, in the fall, I always have to really emphasize self-care. It's the time of year when I can be most easily rattled. You know, I seasonally can experience depression, and it can come on around this time. And so this year just feels like everything has the potential to be accelerated, including my mood changes. So I would be doing a lot of grounding practices and leaning into the teachings on change and impermanence anyway. But, you know, here I am doing that, and so are we all.
Yeah. There's just so much right now that, unfortunately, in some ways, the things that would normally be on my mind, you know, as a parent, getting my kid back into the school routines, that all seems very, very small compared to the bigger things that we're facing.
Yeah.
And then the biggest thing looming over the U.S., and perhaps some people around the world are feeling this too, is the U.S. election.
Yeah.
And I just feel myself tightening every day that goes by. My chest feels a little tighter. My throat feels a little tighter. I'm sleeping less well because it feels very existential right now.
Yeah, it does. That's the word for it. It feels existential. I can go through my day sort of keeping in touch with developments and getting my work done and getting outside. And it can feel okay. And rather than like a progressive tightening, as you described, I'm sorry, I don't mean to giggle. It's just so awful, Jen. Instead of that, the way it sort of shows up for me is these episodes of sudden fear, where generally, I don't know if it's that I'm operating with like a baseline of hope, stability, huge broad picture view, 30,000 foot view. I don't know what it is, but there's ease a lot of the time. And then the fear comes in episodes, anxiety, the sudden tightening in my chest, teariness, you know?
Yeah. So in this episode, Sarah Jane and I are going to take a look at some very practical in-the-moment steps that you can take when you are feeling, like me, that tight chest, growing sleeplessness, or even like Sarah Jane, that sudden panic about our uncertain world and our uncertain future. So we're going to tell you our best strategies for working with in-the-moment feelings. And then we're going to start looking at the ways that we can build up long-term resilience and resourcing us so that the next shoe that drops, we're a little bit more prepared. And finally, we'll wrap up this episode by looking at how some of the wisdom traditions that have foregrounded impermanence and change, how they view this material and how you can wrap it up in a worldview for a really solid long-term understanding of the world. So I thought we could start, Sarah Jane, with our negativity bias and how we're hardwired to be on the lookout for the worst case scenario. It's part of our evolutionary biology and something that was necessary for our ancestors, especially when we were still living much, much closer to the land. But our lifestyle and our culture and our technological developments have outpaced that aspect of our brain. And so this heightened sense of alert, and for me, you know, it's this kind of ongoing constriction that doesn't let up. And for you, it's these moments of panic. Both of them are indicative of this way that we're oriented, evolutionarily speaking, to anticipate and expect danger around every corner.
Yep, for sure. We are looking for solid ground. We're looking for familiarity, right? Predictability, certainty. But what we have is unpredictability, uncertainty, and unfamiliarity. And this is the pickle, right? This is the human condition. We are really wired to keep ourselves safe, to assume the worst before we know the facts of a situation, even in a split second, right? There's that analogy of glancing down at the ground and seeing a stick and immediately thinking it's a snake before milliseconds later realizing, okay, it's a stick. And that's just like a little glimpse into the negativity bias that you mentioned. So, yeah, we're wired to be averse to novelty and change.
Yeah.
You know, I always thought something was a little off when I was growing up in a small town and everything seemed just so, except it wasn't. I could see people trying to make it just so. And yet there was a lot of pain and people were not comfortable and not okay. And so I think that's why for me it was refreshing to encounter systems of thought that are realistic about life being full of change and actually embracing that. So, against the backdrop of uncertainty and difficulty, there are times of acute stress that need to be addressed in the moment. And, you know, we meet these needs by responding in a way that soothes us, right? So, in the panic I was describing, that's really my limbic system, right, going haywire. And Rick Hansen would say we need to pet the lizard, right? The lizard is the reptile, our reptilian brain. So let's talk about that first. How do we soothe ourselves in the moment? What, Jen, are your go-to practices?
When I'm in a real acute situation, I fall back on Hara breathing or belly breathing. And this is a practice of pausing, you know, and you can go somewhere and sit down and do it, or you can even just standing there in the moment. Maybe if it's not quite the place to close your eyes, you can just soft focus down in front of you and tune into the sensation of breathing, but particularly the sensation of breathing in the lower abdomen, right around the navel center. Many Eastern traditions emphasize this kind of belly breathing. It corresponds in the yoga tradition to the Svadhisthana chakra, which is called one's own abode. So it's considered our body's home. And in Taoism, it's referred to as the lower dantian, which is a vortex of energy, and it's basically the gathering place for life force energy or qi. And even in neuroscience these days, they're talking about the belly or it's the home of the enteric nervous system, the belly brain, and that a lot of neural pathways lead to there and relate to our emotions and our sense of self and survival to some extent too, not to be confused with the limbic system and the brain, but the belly brain is also implicated in our sense of, I guess I would say, existential sense of being. So when we bring our attention down into the belly and we allow our breath to penetrate lower into the torso, we're sending many, many signals to both our belly brain and our brain that we're actually, at least in a survival way, okay. And this is how we soothe the lizard, because that lizard part of our brain is all about survival. And that's it. Is there a threat to my life, my person? Yes or no? It's a binary. And if the answer is truly no, like there's nobody pointing a gun at my head right now, I can impact this. I can tell my lizard brain through this belly breathing, actually, I'm okay in so much as I'm not under threat of dying in this moment, but I need some help. And so we soothe the nervous system back down off the ledge. So that's my go-to.
No, that makes sense. The ground of being, right? You hear it called. Yeah. I love the idea that by coming in, by coming home, abiding in ourselves, we can both soothe. And we're also tapping into what's kind of most essential in a big picture view, right? Like the Buddhists call this the ground of awareness, and the Christians call it the ground of being. And in all these different traditions, we're talking about coming inward in order to connect outward to what's larger than us. And that is almost like two different aspects of self-care. To come in and soothe and say it's okay. And to also remember that we're part of a larger whole. You know, and so it's antidoting disconnection.
Yeah.
From ourselves and from others. And of course that shows up everywhere, right? And we didn't need modern science to tell us how effective it is, because we can feel it when we practice it. I can anyway.
Yeah, same.
Yeah. So, I'm thinking of earth chi and sky chi visualizations using the breath.
Mm.
This is a practice of visualizing that as we inhale, we're drawing earth energy up through the conduits of the legs and the various points in the body where we can access earth energy. And we're bringing that energy into the hara, the lower dantian. And then we can use inhales to draw sky chi, which is earth chi is grounding and the sky chi is uplifting. We can draw that down through the crown of our head into our heart center. And you can pattern this in various ways, but you can do one and then you can do the other for a spell. And then we can intermingle the two energies in our abode, in our home, and it, you know, giving the sense of replenishment and balance, right? Balancing between those two qualities of energy that are so necessary for meeting the world, you know, both grounded and having some activated interest and energy, you know. So I love that one.
Yeah. Sometimes I think, especially as yin yoga practitioners, we can get kind of a little bit down on that more dynamic yang energy. But I do think you make an important point, Sarah Jane, that not only do we need to be grounded and settled and be able to stand firmly on our two feet, but we have to have the vision that comes from that sky chi, that uplifted energy, to see to the other side. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, we'll just lay on the floor and never move again. And that's not really a resource. That's a coping mechanism. But ultimately, we need to find that centeredness within ourselves so that we can then show up for the next moment in the most beneficial way that we can.
Oh, yeah. Too much of a good thing is dangerous.
Yeah. And if you're unfamiliar with the earth and sky balancing practice, it's going to be Sarah Jane's guided practice coming up. So you'll have a chance to practice that. You know, speaking of yin yoga, I also like to do the poses in the yin yoga repertoire that activate the meridians that supply life force energy, chi, prana, to the spleen and stomach organs. And that's largely because these are related to the energies of anxiety and uncertainty and disconnection. And so what happens in the Taoist traditions, energetic medicine in particular, anxiety and ungroundedness and disconnection and muddy thinking, all the things that come along with our panic responses, can be related to spleen and stomach imbalance, mm-hmm. or they can irritate and harm the spleen and stomach. So either way, these are your quad and hip flexor targeted poses. So your dragon pose, saddle. Not everybody loves those poses. I find that kind of funny that they're often viewed as the hardest poses and the most demanding. And yet, there are our go-tos for arguably some of the hardest times in our lives too. So it's a strange combination, but there
mm-hmm,
you go.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm feeling particularly under-resourced, tired, you know, because I'm not sleeping that well lately, the energy that I need to bring forward to be in dragon is not always there. I like to do supported bridge with my tailbone on the block, and then I just stretch out my legs. It'll get the same area with a lot less effort.
I love that. I love knowing that.
To be honest, that's been like my mascot pose for the last several months, maybe even the last full 6 months of the full pandemic. That and a few poses for liver because of the association with anger. But so yes, you can do that. And then also, twist, they're really good poses because they will target all of the meridians and support all of the organs in the system. But because of the location of most of our twists in our middle back area and down at the base of our rib cage, they will target the spleen and stomach directly. So they're really good for those two organs. So when in doubt, who doesn't love a reclined twist?
Yeah.
Just kind of lay there and let gravity hold you while things unwind, tension and that energy that comes, that tightness that I was speaking of, that I find twists really helpful with that.
Mm-hmm. Twisted root, I've heard it called, which I love because, you know, root being something that is in the ground.
Mm. Oh, I've never made that connection. Thank you for that.
Yeah. And I was thinking too, when you were talking about the difficult spleen and stomach poses, dragon, and particularly for me, saddle, you know, maybe one of the reasons why this practice is so effective, leaving aside the meridian theory, is just that when we meet difficulty in safer surroundings, you know, and we practice being with it and we build tolerance to it. And now I'm just speaking about difficulty on a physical level because these poses don't feel great. But that translates, you know, capacitating ourselves to meet difficulty physically, for me anyway, was a big way to become someone who could tolerate difficulty in other areas of life or through other aspects of being, you know, emotionally, mentally.
A word that's coming to mind as you speak is fortitude. Mm. And being able to develop exactly that, the ability to just keep showing up.
Yes. Yeah. 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 And speaking of the ground, what about getting outside?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. My favorite is Buddhist style walking meditation. Just getting really, really super attuned and focused on placing one foot in front of the other, the shifting of the weight between my feet, and it's just very, very grounding, like literally connected to the earth, but it pulls me again back into the body where my mind can get a break.
You know, I was just thinking about getting outside in general. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, no matter what you do, almost. I've just returned from being in a sort of an outdoorsy cottage for the summer. And, you know, there were times when a piece of news would come through and I would just walk right outside in my bare feet. And there's stones in the ground, there's soil, there's grass, there's a patch of wildflowers, just walking through all of it. Frankly, I don't think I even thought of it as a practice. It was just instinctual. Hmm. You know, hearing something come through the news and then banging the screen door open and just
slam it.
That's right. And just getting out there. Anyway, that's me saying yes to the idea of getting outdoors no matter what you're doing. It's just an in the moment way to replenish our reserves and nourish. So, yeah.
So while these in the moment practices are really helpful when we're feeling disconnected, anxious, uncertain about the future and what's coming, the now time notwithstanding, most of us spend a fair amount of time feeling reasonably okay, like everything's going smoothly, and we might even forget about the kinds of things that would build up resources for when things become challenging. And this is coming back to Rick Hansen. He calls it feeding the mouse. Mm-hmm. And to put it another way, you can think of it as actually practicing the tools that are in your toolbox, because unfortunately, the toolbox metaphor falls short in a lot of ways because you can't collect practices and then just call on them when you need them, because chances are you'll forget that they're actually in your toolbox. And so the way that you hold the memory of them and understand for yourself in a really experiential way that they're beneficial is to practice them when you're actually okay. Mm. And then they become something that is second nature to turn towards instead of having to seek outside supports, because they're already there within you.
Yes. To go back to saddle for a moment, I can't imagine being able to do a yin yoga sequence, including a pose like that, in time of acute distress, unless I've already done it when I'm kind of okay many, many times.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah. Or even like the Hara breathing, you know, we can intellectually be like, oh yeah, I can see why that would be beneficial. But if you haven't been incorporating it into more of a daily routine, when you're under stress, it's not going to be the first thing you think about.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So both.
Right, right. You won't think of it, number one. And number two, you won't be able to stick with it.
Right.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So doing things as part of a routine, not only in the moment. Yeah. I don't know, routine contributes to resilience, right?
Yeah.
I have with me a Dhammapada verse that I think relates, so I'd like to share it. People call it the drop-by-drop verse. Think not lightly of good, saying, it will not come to me. Drop by drop is the water pot filled. Likewise, the wise one, gathering it little by little, fills oneself with good.
Hmm.
So for me, this speaks to how we can't really fix things all at once. Really, we need to, over time, build up our reserves. Drop by drop, the water pot is filled, you know? So this is how we fill ourselves with good.
Mm.
So the beginning of that verse, think not lightly of good, saying it will not come to me. This is really about transforming a negative view and sort of giving hope that small things you do over time will make a big difference.
Yeah. I think that's a key part to highlight, because one of the markers of uncertainty and anxiety around uncertainty can be at its extreme hopelessness. Like it will never get any better.
Mm.
And so this is saying, no, it will, but it's not going to be a snap of the fingers. It's going to take deliberate action over time. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
I would advocate for this water pot metaphor replacing the toolbox metaphor.
Oh, let's do that right now. Let's make that official in our teachings.
Nobody's saying toolbox ever again.
Oh, not only us, but everybody else.
Yep.
Oh, I think that's good. Yeah. But when it comes to building resilience, I do actually have two go-to methods that I just feel as though if I continue doing them, they give me an outlook or orient me in such a way that I'll be able to handle what comes a little more easily, or at least bounce back.
Yeah.
These are both meditation methods. First is mindfulness of the present moment, you know, just being aware of all phenomena. Material things, experiences, ideas, concepts, whatever is happening. I include in this the first few foundations of mindfulness too, like the sensations arising in the body, the breath happening. And the key insight of this, of course, is the nature of all of these things, which is constant change. So this is about not intellectualizing that impermanence. This is about directly experiencing it.
Yeah.
So like breath comes and goes and sensations arise and pass away and emotions percolate up, right?
Yeah.
And somehow dissipate and thoughts arise and evolve and become something else. And so it's knowing the nature of things in your bones. That's how I like to think of it. And it imparts a realistic view. And it has the effect of making me more okay with everything, more accepting. This is how it's going to go. Something happens that I wish hadn't happened, or something doesn't happen that I wanted to happen, you know, okay.
Yeah.
And sort of a sister practice to that for me, and sometimes I'll follow this mindfulness of the present moment with the sister practice, which is cultivating equanimity. So the idea is that by being in touch with the impermanent nature of all things equanimity may arise, but there's the purposeful cultivation of equanimity using phrases as we do in metta meditation too.
Mm.
And I'll tell you the phrases I use. May I see the arising and passing of all things with equanimity and balance. May I be open and balanced and peaceful. May I bring compassion and equanimity to the events of the world. So those are the three. And I'm often these days trying to use the final phrase in a cultivation meditation to reinforce that I'm doing this because I'm connected to all things. And there's, you know, it's not just I want to capacitate these things within my inner system and feel great about it. You know, there's a purpose.
And if you are interested in experiencing this, in episode 24, Sarah Jane shares an equanimity meditation. So you can listen to that.
Oh, that's right. And I may have used those phrases.
That's good.
Yeah. But I love that meditation. It really, I feel like it installs a sense of ease amidst change, right? And that's what we're looking for, installation, right?
Right, exactly. Feeding the mouse. You know, speaking of meditation, at this period of time when I can build up resilience at a time when I'm doing relatively okay, I fall back a lot on the inquiry type practices like Vipassana or insight meditation or even internal family systems parts work. So really looking closely at the ways that my mind tends to respond to different stimulus. So for instance, if I'm in a yin pose and I'm encountering difficulty, you know, first it starts with there's sensation, and then my mind will quickly go, oh, I don't like that. I want to be doing something else. And then another part of me will jump in and be like, no, we're doing this right now, but let's check out and we'll just think of something else and get through it. And so I get this window into my conditioned habitual response to dealing with difficulty. And then once you know something, you can start to look at areas where I might be less resourced than others so that I can address them before I'm in an acute state of stress.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of yin yoga, I think this is why I like yin yoga so much, because it is a practice ultimately of developing some comfort with discomfort. And I know that's kind of controversial. A lot of people in yoga land think that it should always feel good and that's the experience we should be having. But, you know, you and I, Sarah Jane, come from a totally different camp in this regard, that we can use this practice experience as a lab to get to know ourselves a little bit better. And I love yin yoga for that. You could do it, I think, in other types of yoga, but often we're moving so quickly from pose to pose in more dynamic practice styles. And so we don't have a chance to really see that next level train of thought that kicks in and the way that we talk to ourselves and the way that we relate to ourselves when difficulty arises. Whereas in yin, you're just sitting there staying with it and there's no way to turn away from what comes up. Mm. And so we practice paying attention through the Vipassana methods, and then we get to really see how we show up.
So this is the point where we get to talk about how just deepening our understanding or relationship to the nature of change in the universe, to impermanence, is not only helpful, you know, in times of uncertainty, but it's transformative. Impermanence is the ground of opportunity for us to grow. You know, I'm not talking about improvement, but growth, to become more human or to understand more what it is to be human, to relate differently to ourselves and to others. And I'm thinking about how there's a Tibetan chant I know of, which I understand that in most monasteries is recited every morning. And I have it here. It's Grant that I might have enough suffering to awaken in me the deepest possible compassion and wisdom.
Hmm.
So
I love that.
It feels hard to say, to tell you the absolute truth. I mean, it sounds a little bit like wishing for suffering. I think it is wishing for suffering, but I think it's done in the context of acknowledging that it's going to happen anyway.
Yeah.
So maybe the focus is not so much on the suffering, because that's going to happen anyway, but it's on the opportunity, you know, to awaken, to produce compassion and wisdom. And that's the ubiquitous lotus symbol. That's what that signifies, is how out of the muck and the mire, and only in those circumstances can this tendril come upward to the surface of the water and bloom into something absolutely beautiful. No mud, no lotus, right? Isn't that Thich Nhat Hanh's saying?
Yeah, and I needed this reminder so much that for a very long time, I had a little piece of paper that I'd printed up, and it was on the dashboard of my car. And then eventually, it's part of the tattoo that's on my arm. So,
oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it says no lotus on my arm.
There's a similar simile that I'm just going to preface this by saying the first time I saw this couplet that I'm about to tell you was on a sign at the Women's March in 2017 in DC. I've seen it everywhere since. So it goes, "What didn't you do to bury me? But you forgot that I was a seed."
Mm.
So again, you know, out of difficulty, oppression in this case, there's great power and potency and potential. Apparently, that came into activist lexicon in Mexico several years ago, but it comes from a Greek poet, 20th century Greek poet, Christianopoulos is his name. So yes, what didn't you do to bury me? But you forgot that I was a seed.
I love that. I just want to touch in on how universal this is, that we've got Tibetan chant, we've got the Zen No Mud, No Lotus, we've got this Greek poem.
That turns up in Mexico.
Mexican Exodus and now the Women's March. And that there's this idea that, you know, we don't have to view all this difficulty in such a negative cast. You know, the resiliency comes out of it from getting through. And then also a determination that can arise, and that fortitude that we spoke of earlier. And we can let that suffering and that uncomfortableness, that tension that I'm feeling in my body, and you described as well, as the fuel to propel us forward rather than just laying on the ground and rolling over.
Right, right. And the seed is the hope.
Yeah. And so speaking of it being very universal, this idea of change being a fundamental aspect of our manifest existence, otherwise known as impermanence, is so essential to the Buddhist tradition that it basically takes up about one third of the whole view of Buddhism. You really have to kind of zero in on this and two other things. Also,
which we'll get into another time.
Yeah. Not enough time to get into all three marks of existence. But until you really touch in and experience this fully, like Sarah Jane described, in your bones, then true enlightenment isn't possible. And so impermanence is something that we can chew on and mull over and roll around in our mouths and in our minds for a lifetime. For sure, but it won't take a lifetime to realize the freeing nature of this teaching.
Oh, I'm thinking too about how there's an undoing and a remaking inherent in change,
yeah.
and that's the hope.
Right, It's that same thing when we look at nature. The leaves must come off of the tree. The perennials must die back and decay into the soil for the new growth to arise. So this is, it's not just something that's inevitable, but it's a must. It has to happen.
It's necessary.
Yeah.
So, you know, saving the best for last, we really need to call out community as something in which to build well-being. I mean, when we're acutely distressed, frankly, and in terms of long-term strategy for living. So the Sangha, the community of practitioners or just family or whatever communities you have, these are deep wells of nourishment. So, you know, as simple as calling a friend when you're in distress, even just to complain, you and I have been talking about this, complaining as a spiritual practice, right? So that can dispel stress. It can enhance a sense of connectedness. You know, frankly, it can just make you feel like, okay, I'm not crazy. You're feeling this too. So important. And in terms of long-term strategy, those of us who belong to activist communities or spiritual communities, you know, often find that our longer range or longer term efforts in terms of engaging with the world and trying to grow individually and collectively have a home there.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a nice note to end on, getting connected with community. And as promised, we mentioned at the top of the show that we are going to be changing up things a little bit in November, offering 3 days of practices on November 20th through the 22nd. Sarah Jane and I both are going to drop practices around a specific theme. And we'll put that in the show, but we're also going to invite you to join us live on Zoom in an opening and a closing call. So we'll announce more details about that in our next episode, but I wanted you to be able to save the date, November 20, 21, and 22. And you'll want to make sure that you're a subscriber so that you get all of that content when it comes.
We really thank you and appreciate you, dear listener. And we do want to know what you think about the show. Are these teachings resonating? Do you have something you'd like us to cover in future episodes? How can we support you? Drop us a note at feedback@skillfulmeanspodcast.com. Or you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram @skillfulmeanspodcast. Until next time, may our minds turn towards those practices that engender inner freedom.